Today at Reader's Corner, Brian Hare, author of The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think.
More than ever, dogs have more jobs. You know, dogs are being trained in new ways all the time. I think there are so many cases of species in nature that have a mutualistic relationship where both parties are benefiting. What makes dogs special relative to other species is a really unusual ability to communicate with humans. And that's not surprising, really, because we all communicate with our dogs and we know them so well. I think what's surprising is to learn how the thing that we're doing all the time with our dogs is really remarkable in the animal kingdom.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Without question, dogs play a major role in the daily lives of many of us. In the United States alone, there are 83.3 million pet dogs, and 47% of all American households include at least one dog. Brian Hare finds the popularity of dogs far from surprising. In his book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think, Dr. Hare and his co-author and wife, Vanessa Woods, describe how dogs evolved from wolves to become man's best friend. The book, now out in paperback, provides a thoughtful and entertaining account of the last decade's explosion of research and understanding about where dogs came from, how they think, and why they have become so cherished and beneficial companions. Starting with the discovery of a puppy's seemingly innate and unique ability to understand human gestures and body language, The Genius of Dogs explains the research of recent years, suggesting that the ancestors of our canine friends chose human companionship, not the other way around. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Brian Hare. He is an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University and studies dogs and primates as a member of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, which is a division of the Duke University Institute for Brain Sciences. Dr. Hare has published dozens of articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and his research has been featured in many publications. Dr. Hare joins us by phone from Duke University for this interview. Brian Hare, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Well, I'll tell you, for those of us who are dog lovers and affiliated with the university, you have the ideal job in the world. You get to combine your academic career goals and objectives with the fact that you have your own history of dog ownership and dogs that you grew to love and dogs that actually played a role in your research.
That's right. No, absolutely. My own childhood best friend, Oreo, who was a black lab, I mean, he really altered my research career and actually had a big impact on who I became. And, you know, of course, I didn't know that that was going to happen, and maybe he did. I don't know.
Well, aside from your love for Oreo, why is it important that we study dogs?
Well, I mean, you know, as you said in the introduction, dogs are everywhere. And it's not just that there are pets. Dogs today have more jobs than ever. And you would think that in the world with the internet, international space stations, et cetera, that you know, dogs are obsolete, and what could they possibly contribute? Actually, more than ever, dogs have more jobs. They're doing everything from, you know, detecting cancer, helping people who have all sorts of mental, physical disorders, disabilities, whether it's suffering from diabetes, helping autistic children, whether it is, helping somebody who is wheelchair-bound. Dogs are being trained in new ways all the time. And of course, there's, you know, other applications as well, things that we're familiar with, like finding bombs to protect soldiers in Afghanistan, and things we're less familiar with, where dogs are actually playing a role now in helping understand the population densities of endangered species, because you can train a dog to smell the scat or the feces of a species that you're interested in, seeing if there are any individuals in a certain area. And they can find out much faster than any people can in most cases. So dogs have more jobs than ever, and that's why if we can understand how they think better, we can help them do an even better job in helping us.
So what kind of work goes on at the Duke Canine Cognition Center?
Well, it's really a different way to do science. with animals than has been done traditionally. So we don't have a laboratory. We don't have any animals in cages. What we do is we invite people in the local community to bring their dogs in, just like you would do if you were going to study the development of human intelligence or human psychology. You would invite people in the local community to bring their children in, play games with those children to see how they think, and then those kids go home and have, you know, their normal life. And that's exactly what we do with people's four-legged children. People bring their dogs in, we play games with them, we see how they think, we see how they don't think. And then that helps us learn about the mind of the dog and, you know, how we better can understand and train and work with dogs that are in our life every day.
And for those of us who don't live near Duke University, I was really interested in seeing the website you have up called Dognition and the comments about what you call citizen science, which is an opportunity for people even far away to participate in your scientific research. Help us understand the role that the website plays and how dog owners might be able to avail themselves of it.
Right. Well, when we opened the Duke Canine Cognition Center, we had people from everywhere, from California to London to New York, writing us and saying, we want to bring our dog. And so we realized there was a big demand for this. People really want to better understand how their dog thinks. And so we built a website called Dognition. It's like dog and cognition combined. And that website, you can go there and play many of the exact same games we play here at Duke. And you can learn about the different types of intelligence that your dog has and what are the strategies your dog relies on. And I think what's really fun are really two components. One is you get to find out about your dog as an individual, because your dog is compared to all the other dogs that have previously played all the games at Dognition. And we provide you for instructions, and you tell us how your dog did, and then that's compared to all the other dogs in our database. But the second component is you essentially deputize yourself as a citizen scientist. And I think the key thing here is we're often, you know, told in the media that science is something that's done by other people. But, you know, what Dognition is all about is to help you yourself be a scientist and you yourself participate in science, because we're learning all sorts of things through Dognition about dogs and then sharing it with everybody so we all can understand dogs better if we work together. So that's what Dognition is all about.
Well, help us understand what a dog's particular genius is.
Well, so as a species, and the book is really about dogs as a species compared to other animals, Dognition is about your dog as an individual and its potential genius that it might have. So the book really points out that what makes dogs special relative to other species is a really unusual ability to communicate with humans. And that's not surprising, really, because we all communicate with our dogs and we know them so well. I think what's surprising is to learn how the thing that we're doing all the time with our dogs is really remarkable in the animal kingdom. So even chimpanzees and bonobos, our two closest living animal relatives, are not as good at communicating with humans as dogs are. They're brilliant in many other ways and more brilliant than dogs. But in this area of communicating with people, they're not that skilled relative to dogs. And when we look at wolves, we see the same thing, that wolves really, they're really good and really smart at solving problems on their own. But when it comes to communicating and working with humans, they really, really, really struggle. And so the secret to the success of dogs as a species and their genius as a species, and what we talk about in the book, is the fact that they really have some special social skills. And we go through the story of how those were discovered and exactly what they are.
And you talked in the book about how dogs have a way of watching and looking at you. And boy, I was telling you before the show about my dog, Sadie. When I come home from work, this dog puts a bead on my face. And it is really a series of questions. Okay, are we going to go for a walk? Are we going to go for a ride? Are we going to read a book? Am I going to have to sit at your feet? Do I get out the back door? What's going to happen next? You can see that. Now, I hadn't really thought about all that until I read your book and until I thought about what you talk about regarding visual gestures. Help us understand that.
So one of the things that happens during human development early is that kids start paying attention. I shouldn't even say kids, infants start paying attention to where you're pointing and where you're looking. And they use that to inform what they understand about what others want and what others are thinking and what others believe. And so what we found is that that really is the key thing that's happened during domestication that has allowed dogs to be so such great companions, is they are very similar to young human infants around the age of 12 to 24 months of age. They can pick up on our gestures. They can use the direction that we're looking to ask and answer questions about what it is that we want in a way that other species cannot. You know, when Sadie is locking gaze with you, in a lot of ways she's asking you questions, or asking questions about what it is that you want or what it is you're going to do next. There's even more, though, to that. It's interesting, is there's a physiological response both in you and your dog that's been demonstrated. So when a dog stares and makes a lot of eye contact with you, we know now that that actually produces oxytocin in your body and in the dog's body. And oxytocin is known as the hug hormone. That's the hormone that leads to social bonding. So it's actually, they're asking questions about what it is you're going to do next and what it is you want, but they're also, it just feels good, and it helps the two of you bond when you lock gaze with them.
You're listening to Brian Hare. He's the author of The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And that reminds me of that part of your book where you take us back to the self-domestication of wolves. And mm-hmm. And I mentioned that in the intro where, hey, maybe we didn't choose them, dogs that is, but they chose us. How's that?
Right. Well, you know, I think often we think that, you know, sort of dogs were created in our image by us, and we decided to make dogs one day. Wouldn't it be good to have dogs? Because they're wonderful. It seems obvious that that's what happened now, but if you travel back 15,000 years ago when the first evidence that dogs began to exist, 15,000 years ago, all humans lived as hunter-gatherers, and our biggest rival as we were hunting and gathering were the wolves. As super predators, humans had wiped out all other predators in Europe and Asia, except for wolves and brown bears. And so you can imagine how annoying wolves were to humans. So the idea that, you know, an animal that is actually reviled cross-culturally was somehow people were waking up in the morning going, I know what we need. We need, when we go off and hunt and gather, we need some wolves to stay with our kids at camp. You know, I just don't see that as a viable hypothesis. So what we think we have shown now is it's much more likely that as humans began to settle, as they began to sort of live in encampments, they did what humans always do when you live at high density and don't go anywhere. We generate a lot of garbage. And our garbage was, if you're a wolf, an absolute delicacy because we eat such similar things. And so if you're a wolf who can sneak in and basically be friendly and interested and non-aggressive towards humans, you're going to be a wolf that has a very, very rich, steady diet that other animals who are also wolves wouldn't have access to. And you're going to do better. You're going to reproduce better. You're going to have more offspring. And you're going to create a new population of wolves that are more dog-like. And that's going to continue over many generations until finally humans are seeing these animals that are not threatening, that actually when they're around, they bark in a way that warns them of you know, dangerous things. So people start tolerating these animals and the relationship is born. So essentially wolves chose us. It's not that we chose dogs.
And there's a Soviet biologist who really tried to prove this out to some extent with his work on foxes.
That's right. And so that's why we feel confident about the story, because a story is just a story until you can test it, right? And so Dmitry Belaev, who is just a fascinating character in the history of genetics and in the history of behavior, he set about to test this idea. And essentially, he created two populations of foxes, one that was bred in relation to how they behave towards people. So basically at 7 months old, they would go stand in front of each of the foxes in this population, and they would see whether they were interested and friendly towards people or were they aggressive. And the ones that were friendly and dog-like, they bred them together. The ones that were aggressive, they did not breed. And they did this for over 50 years. They had a second population that they bred randomly, so randomly in regard to how they dealt with people. And so now, 50 years later and 50 generations later, the experimental population that they bred in terms of how they respond to humans and whether or not they were friendly or not, they're as friendly as dogs. They want to jump in your arms when you see them. They never bite. And behaviorally, they are totally dogs. They follow people around, etc. But what's even more interesting is they have floppy ears and curly tails, and they have different colored coats. And all of those traits were completely accidental. They were not intentionally selected. And the reason we know that it was because of what Belayev did is because he had the control population that he didn't do the selection on, and you do not see any of those same traits. That population is not friendlier, and they don't have curly tails and floppy ears and different color coats like the other foxes do.
You know, when it comes to the motives of these animals, I remember a year or so ago, it might have been longer than that, somebody came out with a study or drew a conclusion that dogs were all out there to manipulate humans. Dog is a man's best friend is a fiction, no such thing. And when you talked about the way the wolves got close to the humans, it was actually for food, as you say. And I just wonder how you, as a scientist and a researcher, react to that. First of all, I don't know whether you have any recollection of that study. There was a huge outcry from dog lovers around the world. I beg your pardon, my dog loves me and he's not manipulating me. But there is a little something about your research that suggests there's a partial truth there.
No. Yeah, actually, that was a book written by Stephen Budiansky, I think, and he's a reporter. He's not a scientist. And so he was interpreting the scientific literature as he thought appropriate, and he just made that case. You know, I think that when you're talking about the relationship of humans and dogs, and I have a pet dog right now, and obviously I've grown up with dogs and I'm a dog lover, and I do not think that the relationship between humans and dogs is somehow parasitic and based on dogs somehow manipulating us, you know, purely, and that's the that's what motivates or sustains the relationship. I think there are so many cases of species in nature that have a mutualistic relationship where both parties are benefiting. I mean, just one that comes to my head is the relationship between grouper and eel. So eels are very thin and not very fast, and they're able to go through coral and chase out fish. Grouper are big and fast, and it ends up that grouper will go ask eels to help them chase fish out of the coral reef. The grouper will then eat them, and bits of the fish will break off, and then the eels can also get food. That's a mutualistic relationship. And that's, I think, what we have with dogs, where both species benefit from the relationship. Now, that doesn't mean that dogs aren't smart enough in the relationship to sometimes manipulate us. But the fact that sometimes they manipulate us doesn't mean that the relationship exists because of manipulation. I think it exists because we have a very nice mutualistic relationship.
Well, I think that's a much better answer than the other guy gave. So I'm going to stick with Brian Hare's research as far as that's concerned. So the best bumper sticker, Brian, that I see as I'm pulling up to a stop sign is the one that says, "My dog is smarter than your honor student." I mean, that I don't know where these people get these, but I want one of those bumper stickers, okay?
So one of your listeners needs to send you one.
That's right. So that brings me to your chapter where you talk about best in breed. And
yes.
And it's about more than just this issue of which dog is smarter, because I also want to talk about your aggressive breed myth discussion. But let's start with the smartest dog. Sadie's a border collie. So, of course, my wife and I are absolutely convinced that we have the smartest dog on the planet, even though she's deaf. So that complicates things when it comes to being able to communicate with her, although hand signals work very well. But you throw a little cold water on this idea that those of us, whether you're a golden retriever owner or a lab owner or a border collie owner, think you have the smartest dog. That may have to do with other things and really not necessarily mean it's the smartest breed. Help us understand that.
Well, I mean, I guess it just depends on what people are talking about when they say smart. I mean, I think if we want to test it, if we really want, if our question is one breed better at remembering things, at feeling empathy towards people, at communicating with people, at being able to reason about problems they've never seen before, at manipulating us and being cunning? Those are all very measurable things, and those are all exactly the things that you can measure, and we help you measure at Dognition about your dog. And when you measure those types of abilities, those types of intelligence, in your dog, with all the data that we have at Dognition and all the data we have using conventional techniques, there's really not huge differences between breeds in the cognitive abilities that we examine. That doesn't mean that there aren't any, and it doesn't mean that they're not breed differences. But I think that, you know, on many of the abilities that we would value in our dogs, things like being empathic or having empathy towards people, yes, there's tremendous individual variability in dogs. One dog can be very different from the other dog, and that's why Dognition is so exciting, because you can see where your dog is. I actually found out through Dognition, I thought my dog didn't have much empathy, but my dog is one of, relative to other dogs, has a ton of empathy towards us, and I didn't know that. I also found out that he doesn't use his working memory very much, and when he sits and stays and doesn't listen to me, now I know it's not that he's disobeying me, he just literally forgot. So, you know, I don't know how you know who's smarter without comparing. And what I know is that before Dognition, there really was no way to do that comparison. Mm-hmm. I know other people have made lists and said this dog is smarter than this dog or whatever. But if you want to do it scientifically and you ask the person who made that list, can you show me the measures that you took to establish that? I mean, there's nothing. So maybe there are breed differences, but we don't really have any good data right now that it's something hugely important.
You're listening to Brian Hare talk about his book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think.
And you also comment, I believe, on the fact that when you see some of these dogs performing the way border collies often do with these obstacle courses, and I'm not referring to those correctly.
Agility training.
When you see dogs going through that, there's a lot of border collies there. But I think one of your points was that doesn't mean other dogs can't do that as well. It's just that for whatever reason, border collie owners seem to be driven toward agility training or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's a reasonable alternative idea. And I mean, one of the funniest studies that we uncovered when we were writing the book is a study by Professor Helton in New Zealand. And he actually did a study where he showed different photos of different dogs with different morphologies, different shapes of their faces. And he just asked people, you know, which dog is smarter? And he asked them to attribute different things to the different dogs. And he did this with hundreds of people. And of course, they didn't know the purpose of the study. And what he found was that people, without seeing the dog, knowing anything about the dog, conclude that dogs that have short noses, so like a pug, and dogs that have really long noses, like a Saluki, they're not particularly intelligent. Whereas dogs with sort of noses that are of middle length, those are the most intelligent dogs. I have no idea why people have that bias, but it's definitely not based on any data or anything that's been measured. So I think we have biases about what we think dogs can or cannot do. And that's why, again, Dognition is so fun, because you can actually see. We can actually go measure. You know, is the Afghan hound, which everybody always says is, you know, not particularly intelligent, you know, it may be that it's not that it's not intelligent, it's that it has a different type of intelligence. It may be that Afghan hounds, for instance, are incredibly cunning. And, you know, maybe they don't rely on their memory very much, or maybe they don't rely on our communication, but maybe they're incredible at reasoning in a way that other breeds are not. So I think the big thing to understand is there are different types of intelligence, and different breeds of dogs, or even really individuals, may be using different strategies, and that might bias how we think about them as being smart or not.
Well, one of the things I noticed, speaking of which is the smartest breed, in the paperback edition of The Genius of Dogs, subtitled How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think, you have a picture of what appears to be a Great Dane on the cover. And his eyes either suggest somebody who's totally clueless, and I'm not talking about all Great Danes, just about this one, or somebody who's really clever, somebody who's fooling all of us with these eyes that just look kind of sad, as a matter of fact. I'm just kind of curious, do publishers make those decisions? Did you give your dogs a vote on who gets to go under the cover? how do you figure out what dog gets on the cover of a book called The Genius of Dogs?
That was completely the publisher, and I think the artist just thought, since it was going to be a white cover and the dog was white with black spots, that it looked really pretty. The only thing that I asked was that whatever dog was chosen, that it had white sclera. And the reason that I ask that is because I know that people are much more likely to see an animal as more human-like if it has white sclera. Mm-hmm. And sclera is the white of your eyes. Mm-hmm. And so that was the only thing that I requested.
Yeah, well, you know, the opposite of that, this is a little bit of a stretch on what you're getting at, but don't they say that the last dog in the shelter to be adopted is the black dog?
That's right, and that's one of the places where Dognition is having a big impact already. Well, we donate memberships to Dognition, hundreds of them, not just to service dog providers, but also through Petfinder, where we're partnered with lots of different shelters now. And what we're doing is people will use the Dognition toolkit, and you then get a report about your dog when you finish playing the games. And the report's, you know, 10, 15-page report about how your dog compares to all the other dogs in the database, you know, how your dog is similar or different to chimpanzees or rats or wolves or even ravens, depending on the test. Because a lot of these games you'll play with your dog have been played with a lot of different species,
so
also
you,
cats.
Exactly. You also make a comment about the aggressive breed myth. And cut the pit bull some slack here, because the pit bull is maligned on a fairly regular basis, in some cases for good reason, to the extent that they've been drawn into dog fighting perhaps more often than other dogs. But you have another way of looking at it.
Yeah, and to link those two answers, I mean, Dognition is being used at, you know, shelters, and what happens is you get your profile of the shelter dog, and it may be physically unattractive, but then when people see the report about what's inside the book, then they fall in love. And dogs that have not been able to be adopted, they're getting adopted within 10 days once Dognition's used. So that is absolutely true, that people respond to what the dog looks like. In terms of pit bulls, I mean, the story there is there's really not good data in the literature that pit bulls are in any way, shape, or form different or more aggressive than other breeds of dogs, or actually even lead to more bites. The biggest, most clear pattern in terms of who gets bitten by dogs in serious ways are if you have a child who is male living with a male dog in the suburbs, and the parents leave the child and the dog alone, and the child happens to be male. That is the number one predictor of a serious injury to a child by a dog. And I think that if people who wanted to show toughness by having a dog on a lead, if they all of a sudden started choosing pointers, German short-haired pointers, or if they started choosing chihuahuas, that then would be the dog that people would blame for all of society's ills. I think it's not about the breed of dog. It's about who has that breed of dog and then how that generates fear in us.
Well, thanks to your research, it sounds to me like we're headed for some really exciting years of development and discovery when it comes to just what is going on in the dog's mind. Is it fair to say that you're generating faculty and graduate students who will be doing the kind of work you're doing and spreading the good work on, who knows, in 20, 25 years, we may be able to really get inside the mind of this dog?
That's exactly right. And, you know, Yale has just opened a Canine Cognition Center, and I'm hoping Boise State will be soon. And there's lots of people who are getting into this area of research, and I do think it's going to be a nice area in the future. And truthfully, we've learned more in the last 10 years than we had in the previous 100. So I hope that this is going to be a growth area for sure.
Well, Brian, it's been great talking with you. Really fun and educational reading your book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And remember, our listeners out there, to get onto the website of Dognition.com, sign up, and become a citizen researcher. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Hey, it was great fun. I appreciate it so much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Brian Hare. Next week, Rod Grammer, author of the novel The Good Assassin. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.